Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Maggs.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, Africa redraws its trade map, how smarter borders and modern customs could reshape the continent's economy. Can artificial intelligence help solve the country's water crisis? Cannabis could be a big business. What's holding South Africa back? And is fine wine and art a smart path to wealth? It's Thursday, the 31st of July. As global supply chains evolve in response to ongoing geopolitical tensions, sustainability demands, and rapid digitization, African nations are reimagining how to move goods across borders. It's become an imperative. And there's a new guide from PwC that highlights how 10 key African markets, including South Africa, are modernizing customs frameworks, simplifying procedures, and unlocking new trade corridors. It's a bold reset of cross-border trade strategy aimed at economic growth, investment attraction, and deeper regional integration. But can all of this work? Well, I'm in conversation now with Bianca Romans, Associate Director in Tax and Legal Services at PwC South Africa. Bianca, a very warm welcome to you, and maybe a good place to start is with the big picture. Why is now the moment for Africa to start rethinking how cross-border trade actually works?
Thank you, Jeremy. Navigating the complexities of global trade has never been more challenging. Africa is currently undergoing rapid trade transformation amid global supply chain shifts, geopolitical shifts, as well as the increased environmental focus. So as we are witnessing these transformations, understanding regional customs and cross-border trade becomes crucial. So this guide really helps business to navigate these trade regimes, tariff structures, and incentives. Importantly, compliance is key. Getting it wrong can be costly, both financially and from a reputational perspective. So awareness is essential, not only to maintain compliance, but to also identify and unlock trade incentives, as well as market opportunities that many businesses may otherwise overlook.
Let's take a look at the importance of compliance in just a moment, but I'm wondering if all of this is a response to the global instability that I suggested at the start of our conversation, or maybe a clever, proactive strategy for growth, which is also essential.
Definitely. We do need to look at what is happening globally and understand what can we in Africa do to pivot and ensure our long-term success. And that we are doing within Africa with a multifaceted approach by combining policy reforms, trade modernization systems, regional cooperation, as well as international partnerships to ensure that customs and trade policy are strategic enablers and not barriers for business, and that positions the African continent as a hub for efficient, reliable, and secure cross-border trade.
So, Bianca, let's get back to compliance now. Obviously critical, but where would the weak points in that be? What would fail in terms of compliance, and how could it be fixed?
So, trade is quite a complex topic, and the main pillars for compliance lie with valuation, tariff classification, as well as document retention. So if you get any of these pillars incorrect, the implications can be quite significant in that the customs authorities and the laws governing customs allow for significant penalties, interest, even forfeiture, which is a penalty triple the value, the customs value of the goods, and even seizure or jail time. So compliance is key to ensure business continuity going forward. To fix those gaps, business needs to be aware of the legislation applicable in their country, as well as in the countries to which they export, because that also impacts your compliance status and your ability to move your goods into those export markets.
Bianca, the report focuses on 10 markets. So how significant is their collective progress in reshaping this landscape? And are there front runners among the 10, perhaps? And if there are, what would they be doing more successfully or differently?
So their success would center around the reforms and how far along in the process these countries are in implementing those reforms. So the first and foremost is the African Continental Free Trade Area Agreement, which is providing access to 54 African countries. Every country is in a different stage of implementation, Kenya being at the forefront, as well as Ghana in that aspect, and South Africa has come on board. So we do have 54 African countries that have signed the agreement. 45 have actually submitted their, 48 have deposited their instruments of ratification, which is the formal step needed for the agreement to take legal effect in the country. And so that in itself is a big step forward. We then also have the focus on the Authorized Economic Operator Program, with the objective to promote and reward compliance while facilitating faster and more secure trade. So with that intention in mind, there are benefits for traders who are AEO accredited in that they are able to benefit from faster customs clearance, fewer inspections, lower costs, and priority treatment. So again, countries within Africa are all at varying stages of implementation. South Africa is fully implemented and actually making very good progress, because the uptake is exceeding 830 traders as of the beginning of this year. Kenya, as well as Ghana, are also doing significantly well in this space. And the focus on that area remains growing. And then other reforms are still being implemented or in place in countries, but are not being effectively utilized. And those can have a significant impact on business success.
And Bianca, sustainability these days is a key factor when it comes to trade. Are African nations balancing green goals with the need to grow and industrialize? That's a tricky one.
Yes, it is an important one as well. Sustainability is gradually being embedded in African trade strategies. So countries like Egypt are incentivizing electric vehicle imports through full customs exemptions, and South Africa's carbon tax is integrated into our customs framework. So those are just examples. But moreover, customs authorities are actually starting to green their own operations, and that is through paperless clearance systems and digital tracking. The key for the customs authorities is to ensure that sustainability is not seen as a trade-off, but as a growth enabler, especially in sectors like renewable energy, clean transport, you know, eco-friendly manufacturing. So we are seeing that shift begin to take hold.
Bianca Romans, thank you very much indeed. Associate Director in Tax and Legal Services at PwC. I appreciate your time.
Hashtag Dinnertime Stories SA. Mind-blowing, innovative and internationally acclaimed, Le Petit Chef is a gastronomic experience like no other, a unique, never-to-be-forgotten 3D and 4K tabletop projected dinner filled with fun, surprise and storytelling. Fancy a journey across the globe without ever leaving your seat. You could win two tickets worth nearly 4,000 Rand to experience the world's tiniest chef with the biggest culinary adventure. Enjoy six unforgettable courses inspired by Marco Polo's travels, from the fragrant spices of India to the icy peaks of the Himalayas, all paired with fine wine in a luxury setting at Blueberry Hill Hotel. Enter now at events@moneyweb.co.za and tell us about the official hashtag for the event. Your taste buds are ready for takeoff.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
South Africa is running out of water, not just in its dams, but in its ability to manage the crisis, with nearly half of the country's treated water lost to leaks, theft, and poor infrastructure. The challenge, I would suggest, is urgent. But could artificial intelligence be the unexpected hero in this old and very deeply human struggle? From detecting hidden leaks to forecasting droughts and flagging corruption, AI is starting to emerge as a powerful tool in the fight for water security. And in that respect, I'm in conversation now with Dr. Lester Goldman, who's Chief Executive Officer of the Water Institute of Southern Africa. Dr. Goldman, a very warm welcome to you. And very briefly, let's just begin with the crisis itself. How serious is our water situation right now?
Thanks, Jeremy. The sector stands at a critical juncture. We're grappling with an ecosystem of aging infrastructure, pollution, governance gaps, and climate variability. So it's not just a technical failure. It almost becomes a social injustice. Millions live without reliable access to safe water, and we lose nearly half of our treated supply. We can't afford to treat this crisis as business as usual. And for us, AI gives us an unprecedented edge. It gives real-time data, predictive insight, and the ability to proactively intervene. So it's more than just automation. It's about making smarter, more ethical decisions, whether that's in leak detections or early flood warnings or digital twins for planning. AI can help us move from reactive to resilient.
So what would the most immediate high-impact ways be that AI could be immediately deployed?
I think AI can be used in numerous ways. Some of these in real-world examples, Rainwater's research chair has been exploring digital pumps, digital twins rather, for lab pumps and maintenance planning. And you get specific stakeholder visualizations using VR and AR. And these aren't just academic exercises. These are prototypes for how we can reconfigure governance and operations. So really, we need to start using this a lot more and adopting it a lot more efficiently and effectively.
Which I guess, Dr. Goldman, begs the question why we're not scaling these solutions already.
I think we're probably not scaling it because we sit with a bit of a funding crisis. And I believe we need to start with high impact, low cost solutions, almost low cost pilots. I think these must focus on leak detection, predictive maintenance, and for example, the use of AI-powered dashboards, because these offer quick wins with measurable returns on investment. We must use existing infrastructure and open source tools to reduce upfront costs. In other words, small wins build trust, and that will help us unlock bigger investment.
From your experience, and I would imagine your engagement, do you think that there is an appetite for this within the broader water stakeholder community?
I do believe there is. I think we need to just scale it up more. Some examples of what is being used, I'm just going to try and give you an insight. We have Itakwini Municipality, for example, that's using AI in leak detection, as well as predictive maintenance, and they've got some good successes with that. We have DWS that's using satellite tracking and AI for dam monitoring. We have Stellenbosch University that uses AI for groundwater mapping. Even recently, and especially during after day zero, Cape Town used AI for demand forecasting. CSIR is busy with smart water metering AI technology in townships. And then the agri sector is also using AI for, you know, irrigation optimization. So it is being used, but what we feel is that it needs to be adopted a lot more effectively throughout the sector instead of these pilots.
Dr. Goldman, not surprisingly, my eye went straight to your report on touching AI's role in fighting corruption in the water sector. We know that is a problem. How exactly would that work, and is it being used anywhere effectively just yet?
I think corruption thrives in where there's non-transparency. And I believe that AI adds visibility, but only if paired with governance muscle. So it's not a silver bullet, but it creates new avenues for oversight that were previously unavailable. I think the challenge is not the tech. It's what we do with it that is important. And we really were at the crossroads that doesn't only need technology, but needs courage. I won't solve our governance crisis on its own, but it's a powerful instrument and tool for transparency, efficiency, and equity. if we choose to use it that way.
Apart from its pure application as far as water management is concerned, you also point to the fact that it can be used to track pollution and monitor industrial activity. Obviously, there is an alignment there. How would that make a real-world difference, do you think?
I think certainly by using AI technology, it makes our expertise, and we've got wonderful experts in the sector, but it allows our expertise to use real-time data to enable better decision-making. And I think that's where we really need to up the game.
You also point to agriculture consuming, I think if I read this correctly, more than 60% of our water. So obviously smart irrigation powered by AI would help in that respect. But the challenge, I guess, would be for application as far as smaller scale or subsistence farmers are concerned. Difficult for them, surely, to access this technology.
Absolutely. And I think that's where the private sector and those in the AI sector can assist us. You know, I guard, though, in saying that we must make sure that certain ethical safeguards are preserved. And this would include, you know, privacy protection, make sure that there's no bias mitigation, or there is bias mitigation, and accountability must be built into these systems. So definitely, you know, there is a need for it.
So finally, then, what needs to happen, in your opinion, either politically or financially, to get this flywheel moving quickly?
I think if I could speak to public sector leaders, I'd urge my colleagues in government and municipalities by saying we cannot afford to treat AI as a distant possibility. These are tools already in play. Even our kids are using them. And these tools can help us anticipate infrastructure failure. It can help us monitor performance and even reduce corruption. We must adopt them. To private sector innovators and tech owners, you have these tools. Ethical innovation doesn't stop just at product development. So support public service professionals with access, with co-design solutions, and with education. This isn't just about corporate social investment. It's a civic partnership that is needed now more than ever.
My thanks to Dr. Lester Goldman, Chief Executive Officer of the Water Institute of Southern Africa.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
South Africa's cannabis economy is stuck in something of a limbo, privately legal, as you know, but commercially paralyzed. Despite the 2018 Constitutional Court ruling decriminalizing private use, the regulatory framework to support cultivation, investment, and trade remains, I would suggest, just half built. Globally, cannabis is booming. It's projected, and listen to this, to top $100 billion by 2030. But South African farmers, entrepreneurs, and traditional growers remain sidelined by red tape and a lot of uncertainty. So what's the path forward here? Joining us is Alex De Wet, director in the agriculture, aquaculture, and fishing sector at the law firm Cliff Dekker Hofmeyer. Alex, a very warm welcome to you. So maybe let's start at the root if we can. What's holding this country back from building a fully legal and functional cannabis industry?
Jeremy, the long and the short of it is that the cannabis sector in South Africa, as you pointed out correctly, made a big shift in 2018 when the Constitutional Court gave its judgment to decriminalize it. But unfortunately, since then, the result has only been the Cannabis Private Use Act, which hasn't been promulgated yet, and therefore we are still awaiting regulations from the minister in order to activate the commercialization of it. So in short, we've got a legal market in the sense that the public out there and personal individuals may use cannabis, but how do they get it? That is the big issue. And that's where at the present moment, government has been a bit slow in producing regulatory reform to activate that market.
Not only slow, but I'd also suggest that government has missed a real commercial moment here.
Jeremy, indeed. I think that because many countries, as much as 50 countries internationally, have legalized the use of cannabis, which has driven the international market on cannabis. And South Africa has unfortunately seemed to not recognize the potential and the growth and the market, especially in continents like North America and Europe, where our product could be could be sold and exported to. So yes, unfortunately, it seems that the government has missed the boat slightly.
And economically, do we know what the cost of this policy paralysis could be?
Well, Jeremy, should we be able to ignite the cannabis market, from statistics and so forth that I've seen, the idea or the number is close to 250 billion rand to the South African economy. So unfortunately, it seems that the government, in the slow move, has missed a great opportunity to expand our economy from this particular market.
So you're arguing, if I read this correctly, for a segmented regulatory model which would be based on use cases like medicinal, industrial and recreational. Why is a one-size-fits-all policy unrealistic?
Jeremy, the reason why we suggest the segmental approach is because the plant has various uses and has various dynamics with reference to THC levels and can be utilized in different sectors. For example, agriculture, obviously we all know the recreational market. So it will lend best for the government to look at these sectors and identify regulations and not try a one-size-fits-all, because then they're looking to sort of group everything, and the regulations are going to not really unlock the commercial value because of the difficulty in trying to capture everything under one umbrella, if I can say that.
Alex, let's talk about the commercial value side of it. I would suggest that banking and maybe access to finance still remains a major challenge due to cannabis's criminal past. Is there a better solution here to unlocking capital for the sector, given the enormous 250 billion rand potential that you pointed out to me?
Well, Jeremy, yes. The moment the government publishes regulations and establishes a commercial market, I believe private investors will then look at the market with a lot more ease, because of the fact that from a commercial point of view, it is still illegal, although the private use is there. But from a commercial aspect, unless you're looking towards medicinal cultivation under the Medicines Act, it still remains illegal. And I can understand private investors' hesitance to look at that market and invest in that market. So it would be definitely beneficial if the government would move on that. And that would entice investors, not just private, but I also believe from a public perspective, to invest in the sector.
Alex, you also mentioned the need to protect South Africa's unique cannabis genetics from global exploitation. That I find very interesting. Are we starting to see, or is there a potential for genetic piracy?
Jeremy, yes. South Africans, we are blessed with brilliant genetics, as our history has shown, and from a traditional perspective as well. And unfortunately, if we don't protect it, we risk losing strains. We risk breeding rights not being protected or safeguarded. And that would, at the end of the day, mean that our South African ability to produce top quality strains will be affected. So yes, unfortunately, it is imperative that we look at protecting those rights.
You also say, Alex, that a lot of the global market wants value-added products, not just raw plant material. What's it going to take to build that processing and export capacity here, aside from the red tape that we've already discussed?
Well, Jeremy, it's imperative that South Africa looks at this market, not just from a raw material perspective. As much as South Africa can have the ability to export raw material, the markets in other countries, especially in the Northern Hemisphere, are looking at more value-added products. And if we can harness that by establishing supply chains and further productivity on the product itself, it will lend itself naturally to an expanded delivery within in the international markets.
And Alex, you also talk about cannabis tourism, which sounds like a really good idea. I imagine you're talking about things like wellness retreats and even farm stays. But it's going to be difficult to make that vision surely commercially viable and even community owned under the present system or regime.
Yes, Jeremy, we in South Africa are luckily blessed with a beautiful country, and cannabis actually lends itself to the beauty, the heritage, and everything that our country really offers on a tourism level. I do believe that the government must look at this as a as an important way of getting local communities not to just be passive participants, but real stakeholders. Take the heritage of cannabis from South Africa and show it to the world.
And as you say, something in the region of 250 billion rand here is at stake. That's a fascinating conversation. Alex de Wet, thank you very much indeed. Director in the agriculture, aquaculture and fishing sector at the law firm Cliff Dekker Hofmeyr.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now let's move on to this, and it's no longer just for sipping. Premium wine is now a serious investment class, with South African and global collectors shelling out six-figure sums for rare bottles. Wine investment is gaining traction as an alternative asset, offering financial returns, I guess a bit of rand hedging, and maybe even something worth drinking. But is it all swirl and no substance, and who's really benefiting from the boom? Well, joining me now is Fernando Rueda, Managing Director of Rueda Wine Company, and he's fresh off a successful premium auction that saw bottles of Bordeaux fetching eye-watering prices. So, Fernando, a very warm welcome to you, and this is such an interesting topic. Obviously, wine investment is booming, but let's be honest here. Is it a bubble driven by hype, or do you think it's a genuinely sustainable asset class?
Hi, Jeremy. Thank you so much for having me, firstly. And I to just answer your question off the top of it quickly, it's definitely not a bubble. If we look at wine on a global scale, it has been an alternative asset for many, many years. And I think it's only just starting to get traction. If you look at great wines, they've always been expensive. But more than just looking at price about wine, it's an investment that you can also enjoy. Both, you know, in a wine sense, you could buy a case of wine and sell three bottles to drink the rest of the other three for free. So this is kind of how wine as a wine investment started, let's say 50 to 60 years ago. And now it's just becoming more formalized. And with the South African wine market changing a lot, it becoming more open, becoming more global, these opportunities for us, for example, to start and arise have arisen. And this is why we've decided to take on or to go down the wine investment route.
So you hosted, as I mentioned in my introduction, a premium auction. And if I've got this number right, 190,000 rand for a single Bordeaux lot. Fernando, who's buying at those levels? Would they be collectors, real investors, or people just speculating?
I think it's a mixture of both. It is a, for certain wines, you know, wine is valued at a global price. And you know, people buying those wines are real collectors trying to get these wines because wine, they have a global value. And I guess I wouldn't put to purely speculating. I think speculating in any market, obviously you have people, but it has this a nasty connotation towards it. I also don't want to put the connotation on it's only for, you know, not everything is 190,000 rand for a lot. And not all investment wine needs to be that expensive. But it really does... Depends on the lot and the wine that people are buying.
Look, if you've got another bottle of that 190,000 rand Bordeaux, Fernando, I'm very happy to come and help you finish it. That's really, really not a problem. I also mentioned that wine can be rand hedged. How reliable is wine as a hedge in our economy, which, I mean, I don't need to tell you, is very volatile?
So wine is definitely a rand hedge, especially if you look at... On the blue chip wine investment, you're primarily looking at French and Italian wines. Then the South African wine scene has really like stepped up, and you have, of course, South African investment grade wines. But all these wines have essentially a dollar or a euro or a pound value because of the size of the market globally. So it's definitely a rand hedge. As the price of the rand either strengthens against these currencies, either strengthens or weakens, the price of the bottle remains pretty much the same to what it would be
overseas. That being said, it is also, you know, the wine market has also gone through a massive boom after COVID, I think, like a lot of luxury goods, and then is now seeing a slowdown or a push out of a lot of speculators and things like this.
Obviously, not all wines qualify as investment grade. I mean, that's fairly obvious. So what would make a wine worthy of investment?
It's a good question, because certainly not all wines qualify as investment grade. And, you know, the core about investment grade is wines are normally heritage. And this is outside of when you're looking at provenance of a specific case or bottle, like how it was imported and how it has been stored and the condition of the label or the case and things like this. But really, if you're talking about estates, you're looking at it being historically significant or important in the wine industry, then also consistency. The wines usually have been very good for a long period of time, and a lot of these estates, you're speaking about centuries. And then also demand. How much demand do these estates have versus the amount that they can supply? When you're looking at a lot of very high-end wines, you would have, some make only 5,000 bottles a year, and there are many more than 5,000 people who would want to buy them and drink them.
So I fully understand that not every single lot is going to be 190,000 rand, but is there a danger that high prices could drive wine out of the reach of ordinary South African wine lovers?
I think, you know, what's important to look at is that wine, you get many different categories of wine, and quality wine needs to be obviously a certain price because of simply the inputs that go into making it. So when you look at quality wine, you're normally looking at wine at above 150 to 200 rand a bottle. There's many, many, many great wines that you can buy at that price range that will absolutely blow your mind and can also qualify plus minus as investment grade wines. You just need to be knowing who you're buying.
You're going to have to explain this one to me. I also read that there's a lot of buzz around pairing wine with other luxury assets like art watches and, would you believe, even NFTs. Is this about real diversification or just a bit of portfolio posturing here, do you think?
You know, I honestly believe that wine, first and foremost, as an investment, should be looked at as purely pleasure and enjoyable. And it must be, wine is an important and a special investment because it's something that is fleeting. Once you've stored it, you've taken care of it, you open it and you drink it and you enjoy it and you make memories around that. And I think more than just purely a monetary value of, okay, you buy X bottle at this price and you sell it at this price, I think I don't like particularly putting it with every single other luxury asset class. Yes, it is a luxury asset, but there's something much more human to wine, which is beautiful than, let's for say, an NFT or something like this, which obviously I'm not involved in. But there's a great passion and great people who make these wines, who sell these wines, who are in the wine industry, and it's really about the love of wine. So I think if you take to an investment side, you can lose a bit of this. So we're not trying to encourage people coming as speculators buying wine and purely as an investment class. I think you naturally will get that in anything where prices go up. But, yeah.
Just a final one then. There is a sense that the wine investment market is sometimes a little opaque. I'm assuming that there would be safeguards and even valuation standards in place to protect investors. That's a given, surely.
Absolutely. And that's why, for example, with us, when we have many clients who store their wine with us, we have facilities to store hundreds of thousands of bottles. Everything is stored at 14 degrees Celsius at 70 to 80% humidity. And then everything is cataloged. Then we get full provenance reports. And then we are able to go to the market and value wines that clients have and things like that. So it's very important who you buy your wine from and to have the right partner who you are working with in building your collection or building your investment, because you do get a lot of people who come and they buy wine and this and that, and then it's stored somewhere that's not good. And this has a huge effect. So it's just very important to get the right advice with wine.
Thank you so much. What a fascinating conversation. That is Fernando Rueda, Managing Director of Rueda Wine Company. Appreciate your time. Thank you. And that's where we're going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.